The headlines: Moscow warns of nuclear escalation, saying the United States and its allies are on the brink of an open military confrontation with Russia over Ukraine. Sri Lanka's president flees to the Maldives before officially handing in his resignation amid violent protests against the economic situation. And U.S. police facing criticism over their slow response to tragic school shooting in Texas following the release of its video footage. Hello and welcome, everybody. Our top story for this half hour: Moscow says the United States and its allies are getting dangerously closer to a military conflict with Russia in Ukraine. Foreign Ministry spokeswoman Maria Zakharova has accused Washington of provoking an escalation of the crisis by launching a hybrid confrontation with Russia. She's warning that such actions should lead to direct armed conflict between the nuclear powers. Since the beginning of Russia's military operation in February, the U.S. and its Western allies have been offering military support to Ukraine. Moscow has repeatedly warned Washington over such military assistance, including the delivery of heavy weaponry, saying that will add fuel to the fire of war. Iran has reacted to U.S. claim that it's planning to supply hundreds of drones to Russia. The foreign ministry spokesman says there's no recent development in technological cooperation between Tehran and Moscow. Nasser Kanani said Iran's cooperation with Russia in the field of some new technologies predates the Ukraine war. He added that his country's stance on the war in Ukraine is quite clear and has been officially announced before. The spokesman noted that Washington's claim comes as the U.S. and Europe have, for years, turned aggressive countries, including in the West Asia region, into a storehouse of their lethal weapons. On Monday, White House National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan claimed that Tehran is preparing to send several hundred drones to Russia for use in Ukraine. Iran's Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian has concluded an official visit to Italy. It's been 48 hours of intense activity, which included talks with top Italian and Vatican diplomats, as well as meetings with entrepreneurs, geopolitical analysts, and Iranian expats. Max Shvili has more from Rome.
On Tuesday, Iran's Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian wrapped up a two-day visit to Italy, which is expected to boost Tehran's relations with Rome and the Catholic Church. Amir Abdollahian's visit kicked off on Monday at Italy's Ministry of Foreign Affairs. Iran's top diplomat held talks with his Italian counterpart Luigi Di Maio in pursuit of political, economic and commercial cooperation. The two discussed a number of issues, including the situation in Afghanistan, Yemen and Ukraine, and the resumption of talks on the revival of the 2015 deal, officially known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. At the end of the meeting, Iran's top diplomat stated that there is a promised bright future for the cooperation between Tehran and Rome in the field of energy.
At a political level, it remains to be seen if the Italian government's commitment to expand bilateral relations with Iran is more than just a generic pledge. Much will depend on the outcome of the upcoming U.S. President Biden's Middle East trip.
On Tuesday, the Iranian minister, after participating at a meeting with geopolitical analysts and policymakers at the think tank Institute of International Affairs, held talks with Cardinal Secretary of State Pietro Parolin at the Vatican. How interfaith dialogue plays a key role in alleviating violence and extremism was among the issues touched upon during the meeting. In April, Iran's foreign minister held a phone talk with his counterpart from the Vatican. The top Iranian diplomat talked about painful and inhuman disasters unfolding the world today, which he blamed on a lack of morality and ethics in international relations.
The meeting between the Iranian minister and Cardinal Parolin is an important event, a confirmation of long-standing relations and consolidated friendship between Iran and the Holy See, a meeting that is even more important under the current tensions afflicting the world.
Cultural and economic ties between Tehran and Rome have experienced ups and downs over time, yet Italy has ranked at the top in Europe in terms of volume of trade with the Islamic Republic of Iran. Max Civili, Rome.
Sri Lanka's embattled president has fled the country hours before he was due to step down amid major protests over his handling of the economic crisis. President Rajapaksa flew to the neighboring Maldives on board a military aircraft. He's believed to have left the country to dodge detention. The country has been the scene of demonstrations against a paralyzing economic crisis. On Saturday, the president fled his official residence to avoid an encounter with an angry mob who stormed the building. Meantime, demonstrators are still on the streets around his house. Also, flocks of people are touring the presidential palace without the security forces intervening to stop them. Rajapaksa has promised to resign on Wednesday. Parliament will elect his replacement a week later. Public anger is boiling over in Uvalde, Texas, with residents demanding answers over why U.S. police hesitated for more than an hour before responding to a tragic school shooting.
Yeah, the people want to see it. The parents want to see it. I want to see it, you know, just to make sure that we're going to hold everybody accountable. You know, maybe the parents should have seen it first, but I don't see very many people objecting to it. Look at all the views it has. It has so many views. That means people want to see it. It's hard to watch, but they want to see it. They want to know what happened.
Surveillance camera video of the incident shows officers huddling around the school hallway for 77 minutes without making any attempts to enter the classroom. An 18-year-old gunman killed 19 children and two teachers during that time. Texas Public Safety Chief says a public response was an abject failure. He believes there were enough officers to stop the shooter 3 minutes after he entered the school, but they waited for a classroom key that was never needed. Over 70 people have been killed in U.S. gun shootings this year. This has led to an increase in public pressure on the government. Last month, President Joe Biden signed a law that calls for tougher background checks on carrying guns, but many believe the symbolic gesture has failed to stop the lethal shootings. The Palestinian Resistance Front is criticizing an upcoming visit by U.S. President Joe Biden to the region for serving the interests of the Israeli regime. Hamas spokesman Hazem Qassem says Biden's visit to the Middle East is rather detrimental to the Palestinian cause because it's meant to support Israel's expansionist policies and protect the Zionist project. The Islamic Jihad movement has also reacted. It says the purpose of the trip is to strengthen the Zionist American domination over Arab countries. Hours ago, the U.S. president departed for Israel. The three-day visit will also take him to Saudi Arabia. Biden's decision to visit Riyadh goes against his pledges to make the Arab country pay for the killing of dissident journalist Jamal Khashoggi. But he said that human rights will be on the agenda. Well, we're now joined by our correspondent, Ashraf Shannon, who's joining us from Gaza. Ashraf, welcome to the program. I want to get your thoughts on, first of all, the response that we've seen from the Palestinian resistance group Hamas about the U.S. President Joe Biden's trip to the region. That official of Hamas believes that this trip is aimed at serving the interests of the Israeli regime. Tell us more.
Well, but the Hamas spokesman Hazem Qassem said in a statement that Joe Biden's visit only aims to serve the interests of the Israeli regime, and also condemned such visits because it just gives boost to the Israeli regime and encourages its inhumane practices against Palestinians. Hamas also called for unity among all nations in the Middle East that are against the Zionist projects and also against the American policies to stand together against any scenario that might arise. Specifically, Hamas talked about a formation of a military alliance that includes Israel and some Arab countries in the region, and called for strengthening the relations between those powers in the region that are against Israeli regime. It's worth mentioning that for Palestinians and for resistance movements, especially Hamas, they treat all U.S. administrations as the same, because the U.S. all U.S. administrations, whether the current one or the previous ones, have always supported the Israeli regime. The United States is the biggest military and financial supporter of the Israeli regime, and such support has helped the Israeli regime to increase its attacks against Palestinians, whether in the occupied West Bank, Al-Quds, or the Gaza Strip, Bardia.
Well, Ashraf, how do Palestinians feel about, first of all, the trip overall, and how the issue of Gaza, specifically Palestinians in Gaza, how the situation there, the humanitarian catastrophe, the siege, it's been continuing, and it's also going basically unnoticed and ignored by Western countries, by U.S. allies, by the mainstream Western media. What is the response and reaction by Palestinians when they go through this?
Well, when you talk to anyone in Gaza, I will tell you that the world has turned a blind eye to the issue of Palestinians and the Palestinian cause, and especially their situation in the Gaza Strip that's been under a tight Israeli blockade since 2007, with the help of Egypt in the south as well. And Palestinians for decades have never liked the U.S. administrations, and they know that the U.S. administration, according to Palestinians, they consider the Israeli regime as another state under the protection of the United States. Gaza has faced several wars over the last 15 years, and all aspects of life for Palestinians in Gaza have been worsened because of the U.S. policies, because of the support that the U.S. lends to the Israeli regime. Let's not forget that in 2006, when Hamas overwhelmingly won the Palestinian legislative elections, the United States was the first one to help Israel blockade the Gaza Strip.
All right, thanks a lot, Ashraf. Press TV's Ashraf Shannon joining us from Gaza. 9 EU states have rejected Israel's designation of 6 Palestinian civil society groups as terrorist organizations. The countries say they will continue to work with the Palestinians in a joint statement. The foreign ministries of Belgium, Denmark, France, Germany, Ireland, Italy, the Netherlands, Spain, and Sweden said Israel did not provide credible evidence for its claim. The statement said as long as such evidence is absent, they will continue strong support for the civil society in the occupied Palestinian territories. Earlier in April, UN human rights experts said the Israeli claims undermine their work, as several funders had delayed their contributions while the accusations were being investigated. The rights experts said also called on the international community to continue their support. Nominations in the race to replace British Prime Minister Boris Johnson have closed, with 8 Conservative lawmakers securing enough support to make the first ballot. Candidates needed backing from at least 20 fellow legislators to be on the ballot for runoff votes, which will start Wednesday. Former Health Secretary Sajid Javid, whose resignation last week helped bring Johnson down, was a surprise casualty, failing to make the cut. 2 other candidates, Transport Secretary Grant Shapps and lawmaker Remen Chisti, also pulled out after struggling to gather support. The candidates urged Johnson to replace Johnson, who quit as a Conservative leader last week amid a party revolt triggered by months of ethics scandals. He will remain in office as a caretaker prime minister until his replacement as party chief is chosen. The winner of that contest will automatically become prime minister without the need for a national election. It's the 27th anniversary of the Srebrenica massacre, which saw thousands of Bosnian Muslims slaughtered in cold blood in 1995 by Bosnian Serbs during the war following the breakup of Yugoslavia. The genocide against Muslims was so traumatic that victims remain unfound even to this day. Robert Carter reports on the latest burials and the remaining fears of a repeat.
Another year, and more bodies of murdered Bosnian Muslims have been returned to their families as part of commemorations held to mark the 27th anniversary of the 1995 Srebrenica massacre. Close to three decades after being brutally murdered, the remains of 47 men and three teenage boys were laid to rest at Srebrenica's memorial cemetery.
We found the incomplete bodies 5 years ago. We waited to find more, but it didn't happen. So we decided to bury what we have. Also, I have one more brother who was never found, and I have another brother that we buried before.
It was the worst atrocity on European soil since Nazi Germany, as 8,000 Bosnian Muslim civilians were dragged off and killed by Bosnian Serb forces before being dumped into mass graves. The Srebrenica killings were the bloody peak of Bosnia's war, which came after the breakup of Yugoslavia. The conflict has become characterized by ethnic cleansing and genocide. Many Western countries, along with the United Nations, have been condemned for failing to act in the face of overwhelming evidence war crimes were being committed.
What Muslims need to realise is the years of propaganda by politicians made it all possible. The 8,000 plus dead, the concentration camps, the use of rape of Muslim women as a deliberate weapon of war so then they would breed the next generation of Serbs. All of these horrors happened because politicians wanted to divide so then they could rule. And even now, nearly 30 years later, guilty Serbian war criminals like Milosevic and Karadzic are seen as heroes and their crimes denied.
On Monday, Holland's defence minister publicly apologised for the massacre, admitting the international community failed to offer adequate protection.
But critics claim it's too little, far too late. What's more alarming is that Islamophobia remains a very persistent problem right across Europe. Following the fall of Nazi Germany, anti-Semitism is taken incredibly seriously by European authorities. But can the same be said regarding anti-Muslim hate? Robert Carter, London.
That's a wrap for now.
We are with you. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
According to a United Nations report, a market-based focus on short-term profits and economic growth means the wider benefits of nature have been ignored, which has led to bad decisions that have reduced people's well-being and contributed to climate change and nature crises. We now present you an article written by Phoebe Weston. The piece is titled, UN report finds humans need to value nature as well as profits to survive. A 4-year assessment by 82 leading scientists has found, taking into account all the benefits nature provides to humans and redefining what it means to have a good quality of life, is key to living sustainably on Earth. According to a United Nations report, a market-based focus on short-term profits and economic growth means the wider benefits of nature have been ignored, which has led to bad decisions that have reduced people's well-being and contributed to climate change, and to nature crisis. To achieve sustainable development, qualitative approaches need to be incorporated into decision-making. According to the report by the Intergovernmental Science Policy Platform on Biodiversity and Ecosystem Services, or IPBES, this means properly valuing the spiritual, cultural, and emotional values that nature brings to humans. The assessment includes more than 13,000 references, including scientific papers and indigenous and local sources of information. It was done in collaboration with experts in social sciences, economics, and humanities. The report builds on the Dasgupta Review, which found the planet is being put at extreme risk by the failure of economists to take account of the true value of nature. The report says incorporating diverse worldviews and knowledge systems will be key to leading to a more sustainable future. Professor Unai Pascual from the Basque Center for Climate Change, who co-chaired the assessment on the diverse values and valuation of nature, said there has been a dominant way of taking decisions based on things that look more simple, super quantitative, and more scientific. And we're saying, no, that's not good science. There are a lot of social sciences and humanities and other knowledge systems that can also tell us how to do things. The review highlights four general perspectives that should be taken into account. Living from nature, which refers to its ability to provide us with our needs like food and material goods. Living with nature, which is the right of non-human life to thrive. Living in nature, which refers to people's right to a sense of place and identity. And finally, living as nature, which treats the world as a spiritual part of being human. Professor Mike Christie of Aberystwyth University's Business School in Wales says the type and quality of information that valuation studies can produce largely depends on how, why, and by whom valuation is designed and applied. He added, this influences whose and which values of nature would be recognized in decisions, and how fairly the benefits and burdens of these decisions would be distributed. There are 50 different methods of approaches of making the value of nature visible in decisions. Yet, researchers found that the way stakeholders valued nature was only taken into account on 2% of the studies. Authors say, moving forward, there are many tools available to make the values of nature visible, and these need to be implemented. One way of working in using citizen assemblies, which reflect the sociology of a given people and gives them a chance to discuss their values, interests, and understandings. There are happening at a national level in a number of countries. One successful example was the Indian government's decision not to mine near the Niamgiri Mountain, which is sacred for the Dongariya Kond people. The intrinsic value of the site for rare species and its cultural and spiritual value to indigenous people was seen as more valuable than the financial gains from mining at the site. Professor Patricia Balvanera of the National Autonomous University of Mexico, who co-chaired the assessment, says there are consequences of not taking other values into account, such as environmental leaders being killed because they had claims to land that have been ignored. Professor Balvanera said the evidence shows that if, from the onset, local values are taken into consideration, people will feel part of the project and will be more on board with whatever was agreed. This entails redefining development and good quality of life and recognizing the multiple ways people relate to each other and to the natural world. The assessment was approved by representatives of 139 countries in the city of Bonn, Germany. Professor Unai Pasquale from the Bass Center for Climate Change said, "The delegates who endorsed this report say this is a game changer. They realize we've been going through a way of understanding nature in a too narrow sense, and that has brought us to this situation where we live in a planet with interconnected crises. This report is one ingredient out of many which will be needed to convince very powerful stakeholders and decision makers to start changing the way they treat nature." The Intergovernmental Science Policy Platform on Biodiversity and Ecosystems Service, or IPBES, which is the equivalent of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, IPCC, for biodiversity, was set up to provide governments across the world with scientific advice on how to protect nature. Recently, it released another report that found wild species support half of the world's population, but their future use is threatened by over-exploitation. It comes ahead of the Convention on Biological Diversity, or CBD, COP15 in Montreal in Canada in December, which will set the next decade of nature targets, and authors say the findings should provide a valuable contribution to the process. Elizabeth Maruma Marema, Executive Secretary of the Convention on Biological Diversity, or CBD, says, "I applaud the work of all IPBES experts for this and look forward to its active use by all parties and stakeholders to the convention." The relationship between humans and nature is under intense and increasing strain. The report released recently by the Intergovernmental Science Policy Platform on Biodiversity and Ecosystem Services, and akin to the IPCC report on climate change, provides compelling evidence that humans are overexploiting wild species and habitats. Harmful activities, including habitat destruction, poor farming practices and pollution, have altered ecosystems significantly, driving many species past the point of recovery. In Britain alone, of the 8,431 species assessed in the 2019 State of Nature report, 1,188 are threatened with extinction. Globally, there are an estimated 1 million species at risk, with biodiversity declining at a faster rate than at any time in human history. We cannot ignore biodiversity loss. Biodiversity is the variability that exists among all living organisms, between different species, within species, including genetic makeup, and in wider ecosystems. Billions of people rely on wild species for food, clean water, energy, income, and health and well-being. Annually, crops worth up to £480 billion are pollinated by a variety of wild animals, and an estimated 4 billion people depend on natural medicines for their health care. These vital ecosystem services are fundamentally based on a healthy environment, and this requires biodiversity. Losing biodiversity leaves species and ecosystems less resilient to challenges, such as invasive species or pests, meaning there is an increased risk of whole populations being wiped out and destabilizing the entire ecological network. Nature is a finite resource, and human self-interest alone should determine that biodiversity must be protected. Alongside overexploitation, humans are driving biodiversity loss by destroying, polluting, and fragmenting habitats across the globe. Many of Britain's most important peatlands, which provide a home for rare species such as the hen harrier, have been drained for agricultural use. The Amazon rainforest in South America is being cleared to such an extent that it may be near a tipping point beyond which it cannot recover.
Bring us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello, welcome to The Spotlight. I'm your host, Behrouz Najafi. U.S. President Joe Biden will be traveling to Saudi Arabia and Israel this week for his first official visit to the region since taking office. Now, ahead of the controversial visit, we will dissect the failures that the U.S. has experienced in its foreign policy in this region in the past several years. Now, my guests for tonight's episode of The Spotlight are journalist and political analyst Elijah Magnier, who's joining us out of Marseille, France. Also with us will be journalist and author Daniel Lazar. He's in New York.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to the show, gentlemen. Now over to Marseille. Elijah, let's begin with Syria. You know, just last week we had this report that American forces were escorting a number of tankers. They were carrying, stealing actually, Syrian oil out of the country. So also, you know, Washington tried to oust the president in Syria by, you know, backing terrorists, but to no avail. So the question is, what was the reason for Washington and also its regional and NATO allies' failure to meet their objectives in Syria?
Thank you for having me.
Sure thing.
It's obvious that President Joe Biden has no policy or strategy to adopt in Syria, but following exactly what Donald Trump has established by occupying northeast Syria and stealing the oil. Furthermore, he blocked the road between on the borders of Tanf between Syria and Iraq to cripple the Syrian economy and continue imposing the Caesar Act sanctions, very harsh sanctions on Syria, to cripple the economy and to hit the population, because sanctions are always against the population, regime, or government. Therefore, we can understand that Biden doesn't have any strategy in the Middle East, doesn't have any clear strategy in Syria. It is indeed stealing the oil, particularly in this moment where the war in Ukraine is weighing very heavily on the West and is creating a shortage of energy and an increase of prices. Although in Iraq, too, Biden is not in the best position, where the Iraqi parliament has asked him to leave the country and for the U.S. forces to and their presence, according to a clear decision by the Iraqi people. And yet we still see the Americans are still in Iraq, are still in Syria. They're not leaving against the will of the population,
right?
Because Biden simply doesn't have any strategy.
Okay, we'll come to Iraq also on this show. Okay, now let me ask Daniel about another country in this region where the U.S. foreign policy has failed, Afghanistan. Just recently, you know, the forces that were supposed to achieve the stated goal of nation building, they left that country in ruins. And for the United States, the war in Afghanistan was the most protracted one in history, you know, 20 years, longer than World War I, World War II, and the Vietnam War combined. So what do you think the reason is for the U.S. failure in Afghanistan?
It's a very good question, and the answer is there really is no answer. I mean, the U.S. went into Afghanistan after 9/11 merely to demonstrate that it could, as a show of force. It didn't have to. It was on a campaign to demonstrate that it would, you know, it would not stand for any more terrorist attacks. But it did so by waging war against a government that was only peripherally involved in 9/11. So there was no good reason. It was just a pointless display of force. And once the U.S. got in there, there was no getting out. So the U.S. spent 20 years, it's astonishing. The U.S. spent 20 years, essentially, trying to figure out what to do next. And in the process, when it was all finished and was finally lost control and was finally forced out, it left the country in far worse shape than it found it. So, you know, I mean, so over the course of 20 years, from 1978, when the U.S. started funneling aid to the Afghan Mujahideen, to mid-2021, when it was finally forced to leave, the U.S. just pummeled that country, destroyed it, leveled, one attack after the other. First, in order to dislodge the Soviets, and then secondly, just to sort of show that it was, you know, the biggest, most powerful military power in the area. It's a completely bizarre process that historians will be scratching their head over, I guarantee, for generations to come.
Okay. Now, Elijah, you talked about Iraq, so I was going to also ask you about Iraq, and let's now explore the reason or reasons why the Iraqi parliamentarians are wary of U.S.-led force in their country. You know, they want them out.
For the simple reason, because the Americans have violated every single mandate and agreement signed with the Iraqi government. They're not supposed to send drones. They're not supposed to fly over Iraq or do any military act without the coordination with the Iraqi military and the Iraqi army, and at least the chief of the Iraqi army, that is the prime minister. And we have seen how Donald Trump ignored completely the prime minister of Iraq then, Adel Abdel Mahdi, when the defense minister, Minister Esper, used to call Abdel Mahdi and say, we're going to strike your forces at this point in 20 minutes. And then the prime minister would say, well, you have no right. He said, I'm not asking your authorization. I'm just informing you what we are going to do. Mm-hmm. The U.S. forces killed dozens of Iraqi security forces by bombing their positions. Furthermore, they've killed the Iranian general Qasem Soleimani when he was acting as an ambassador and an advisor to Iraq. And he came to Iraq to the request of the prime minister, again putting Iraq in a very weird position between with Iran, where an ambassador and a general is killed on its territory without the knowledge of the Iraqi. So all these violations that continued throughout the years with the American on Iraqi soil, and then the Iraqi army is trained enough and capable with Hashd al-Shaabi to counter ISIS and all the Takfiri, there is no more reason for the American forces to remain. So now they are illegally in the country.
Yeah, and let's not forget, Elijah, that General Soleimani was not a regular general. He also helping the Iraqis get rid of Daesh. Okay, Daniel, during the presidential campaign in his early days at the Oval Office, Joe Biden used to call Saudi Arabia a pariah state, and he planned to recalibrating and looking to U.S. relations with the Arab monarchy. And, you know, Saudi Arabia has been behind 9/11 attacks. It has a long list of human rights violations recorded. So what's the reason for Biden's turnabout?
Well, really, it's oil. Actually, it's two things. It's oil, it's control of the Persian Gulf, and it's Iran. Three things. I mean, essentially, the U.S. Has been in a partnership with Saudi Arabia since February 1945, when Franklin D. Roosevelt had his famous meeting with King Ibn Saud on the Great Salt Lake in the Suez Canal. The U.S. gave the Saudis an unqualified guarantee of security in exchange for their oil. And over the years, Saudi Arabia has turned that security guarantee into an all-purpose carte blanche to attack whatever country it sees fit. So therefore, Saudi Arabia has attacked Yemen. It has fostered a proxy war in Syria. It has threatened to invade Qatar. And the U.S. essentially has done nothing to stop it. It's even encouraged it at various points. Mm-hmm.
Now, Elijah, also we have U.S. made weapons that are being used by Saudi mercenaries to take the life of Yemeni women and children, and still the U.S. keeps selling them weapons. And 7-8 years pass, and Saudis and their allies, including the U.S., have failed to bring the impoverished nation and the Yemenis to their knees, haven't they?
President Biden failed in all his promises and lied about everything he said during his campaign. Because although he pledged to make Saudi Arabia a pariah and promised to teach dictators a lesson not to supply arms to Saudis and to stop the Saudi war on Yemen and to comply with the JCPOA, he has done nothing of all that. He's going to supply weapons to Saudi Arabia. The ceasefire is really hectic in Yemen, and still Yemen is as poor as it was before 18 months when he took power. And there is no JCPOA that has been implemented so far. So whatever Biden said he's going to do, he's not doing it. And as your guest rightly said, he's coming for the oil, but not for the security in the Persian Gulf, because the security in the Persian Gulf is looked after by its own people and country. And we have seen how the Americans, the British, the Israeli, and the Greek failed to impose their will on Iran in the Strait of Hormuz. And Iran showed that it is Iran that is in control of 19% of the world energy that goes through that passage. Therefore, what Biden said, that the water is very important for the Americans and its allies to keep control of it, is against a mockery, because he's not in control of the water and the Strait of Hormuz.
Mm-hmm. Now, Daniel, let's talk a little bit now about the Iran nuclear deal, or JCPOA. You know, marathon talks between Iran, the U.S., and its European allies resulted in what many called a landmark deal. And the U.S. simply scrapped it. And it even threatened other parties not to follow, not to abide by the deal. And this is another failure on the diplomatic front, isn't it?
Oh, it's a failure. It is a colossal foul-up. And Biden's attitude has been ridiculous. I mean, Biden is just utterly contemptible. The Democrats attacked Donald Trump when he walked away from the treaty in May 2018. They vowed to restore the treaty, which, after all, was negotiated by Barack Obama and Joe Biden back in 2015. So it's Joe Biden's handiwork. But then when Joe Biden came into office and began negotiations with Iran, he introduced additional demands which were completely outside the purview of the JCPOA, which he knew that Iran could not possibly abide by. Mm-hmm. So Biden, after calling for the restoration of the treaty that he and Barack Obama negotiated, set about sabotaging those negotiations. It's completely ridiculous. And as a result, military tensions are rising. The possibility of some kind of military engagement is increasing in that region. You know, and the treaty itself was keeping the peace. It was doing its job. Iran, according to all reports, was abiding faithfully by its terms. It was the U.S. which sabotaged that agreement.
Mm-hmm. Elijah, let's also have your thoughts on the JCPOA.
Well, there is a very good point here not to forget. And it used to go, and people are unaware of, is that Barack Obama and Joe Biden in 2015 did not implement the JCPOA. They implemented some part of it, and Obama instructed all the banks not to deal with Iran. So the habit of no compliance by the U.S. Mm-hmm. goes back from the moment that the JCPOA was signed. And it's not new to the Americans to revoke their signature and their promises and the international treaty. So what Donald Trump did is he dismantled the 2015 that was not fully implemented. And today, Joe Biden is walking along the same road as Barack Obama, not implementing fully the JCPOA, and Donald Trump rejecting it completely and trying to postpone it. Let's see after this trip, because now he's promoting a narrative saying the real enemy is Iran, which is very boring and old and is no longer valid because the government and the regime in the Middle East are meeting together and are talking and do not consider Iran as the enemy they should fight, because they tried all kind of war in Yemen and in Syria and in Iraq, and this language has failed, is mm-hmm. behind us.
Daniel, the U.S. So-called maximum pressure campaign against Iran failed to bring its intended results. That was breaking Tehran's will. Iran resisted what American officials themselves called the most crippling sanctions ever. And Iran even made headways in, you know, in peaceful nuclear technology and nanotechnology and defense industry and other areas. Let's have your take on that.
Well, yes. I mean, sanctions never really work as promised. They're a very blunt instrument. They end up hurting the mass of the population more than they affect the economic elite. And they often, curiously enough, often have strangely positive side effects. For example, I mean, Iran, because international trade was restricted, I mean, essentially was forced to diversify its economy and to concentrate on building its economy up. And as a result, Iran has now the most diverse economy in the Persian Gulf region, certainly 1,000 times more than Saudi Arabia, which is just a economic basket case. So, as with Russia, these sanctions tend to backfire. The U.S., you know, always brags about them, uses them. I think the U.S. has sanctions against 30 countries at this point, but they're just never as effective as they are supposed to be.
Mm-hmm. Elijah, there is another country in the region, Lebanon, that's also been feeling this pinch of U.S. sanctions and interference. Let's talk a little bit about Lebanon and what the U.S. has been doing there.
The U.S. has been trying to break Lebanon's back economically and to make sure that Lebanon doesn't represent a danger to Israel any longer. Because of the presence of the resistance in Lebanon, the country is resisting any deal with Israel over the maritime borders, that Israel wants to take a chunk of the Lebanese wealth and on the border between Palestine and Lebanon. So because of the rejection of Lebanon to submit to the U.S. dictate, and because the U.S. is not a valid partner for peace and as good negotiator, this is why Lebanon refused to sign the deal with the Israelis indirectly. Therefore, the Americans turned the population and tried to turn the population against the resistance that is Hezbollah. Luckily, it has failed because the root cause of all the financial problems in Lebanon are all from the U.S. allies who stole the money and the wealth of the country, encouraged by the Americans who put heavy debts on Lebanon and dry out all the dollars from the Lebanese market to make sure that the Lebanese currency will fall into bits. And the Americans succeeded, where inflation hit its record and the local currency is devalued to its maximum never seen before. However, the population did not surrender, and the U.S. failed in its attempt to break Lebanon's back. We cannot exclude the fact that in Lebanon, the U.S. has some influence over part of the leaders who still are afraid to say no to the Americans. This is why the Lebanese government has rejected deals offered by Russia and China to rebuild the local infrastructure and were submitted to the U.S. will to refuse these offers, although the U.S. offered nothing. So what we have today is the American no strategy in Lebanon but to create a weak country without driving it to the edge of the abyss, but without pushing it to allowing the country to restore and to regain its strength. Because with a strong Lebanon, then Lebanon can say no to Israel and stand against the Israelis stronger than ever.
Okay. Now, Daniel, we've talked about several countries in the West Asia region and the U.S. foreign policy and how it's been working there. So if we want to just sum it up in a nutshell, what's the plan? What is it that Washington is trying to achieve in the West Asia region? Is it stability, instability? And any difference who is at the helm at the Oval Office, whether it's Biden or Trump or whoever?
The second question is a lot easier than the first. It does not make any difference who was at the helm, except for the fact that that Donald Trump had been committed to more isolationist policies, and the Democrats turn out to be much more aggressive, much more imperialistic than the Republicans these days. So that is the big difference. But otherwise, you know, empires run on oil, and they are about, you know, all about exerting their power. Now, as to what the U.S. goals are in the Persian Gulf, essentially, the U.S. policy is driven by Israel and Saudi Arabia. So the U.S. will do whatever those two countries wanted to. And even though the U.S. doesn't import very much oil from the Persian Gulf these days, if any, in fact, the U.S. wants to maintain control of the Persian Gulf because it believes that whoever controls Persian Gulf oil controls the global energy market. And okay. So therefore, it doesn't want China or Russia from assuming that role. So the U.S. feels it's very important to maintain a finger in that pie, just to keep China out.
All right, Elijah, we have only 30 seconds for your final thoughts. Go ahead.
I think the Biden visit to the Middle East is going to be very poor. He is going to go back with a little bit of oil, but not what he dreams about. Mm. He is not the first to take a plane from Tel Aviv to Saudi Arabia, because Netanyahu did that in 2020. And he's not going to achieve what he declared about Iran or about the NATO, Arab NATO, or to bring countries together, whatever. He wants oil because he imposed sanctions on Russia that is hitting him and all his Western allies.
Okay, thank you so much. Elijah Magnier in Marseille, Daniel Lazar in New York.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Seventh Imam, Imam Musa al-Kazim alayhi salatu wa salam, is actually known as Bab al-Hawaij.
قال الإمام الكاظم عليه السلام خير الأمور أوسطها.
زيارة of Imam Musa ibn Ja'far al-Kazim alayhi salam.
السلام عليك يا مولاي موسى ابن جعفر ورحمة الله.
This is Dialogue, a program on the famous conversations of Imam Musa al-Kadhim alayhi salam. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome, dear listeners. I'm your host, Mehdi, and we're talking about the dialogues of Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam. Imam Musa ibn Ja'far al-Kadhim alayhi salam was the direct descendant of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, and he was also the seventh divinely appointed Imam from among the household of the Holy Prophet, peace and blessings upon him and his holy household. Now we find that Imam Musa al-Kadhim's life, in all of its various dimensions, is distinguished in a few things. First of all, he is distinguished in the firmness and the strength for which he stood up for when it came to the right, to truth, to haq. We also find his steadfastness in front of all kinds of events, trials and tribulations, good or bad. And we also see Imam Musa al-Kadhim's luminous behavior, his actions, his morals, and his ethics, of which